Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We as government, we are committed on bringing back peace in the eastern part of DRC. The only thing we are doing now is to make sure we finish the president's inauguration, and then we're going to continue to work closely with our military or in diplomatic level to bring back the solution on all those different questions.
The Democratic Republic of Congo president commits to bringing peace to the country.
Government of Lesotho have endorsed Mr. Joshua Potiba as the candidate for Commonwealth Secretary General, and it is the first Lesotho to be given this kind of a responsibility within that institution, the Commonwealth.
Lesotho endorses Joshua Setipa as the kingdom's candidate for the position of the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations.
The atmosphere here in Abidjan has been electric. Literally, there is so much fun chaos happening all across the city.
And the first football match between the host nation Ivory Coast and Guinea-Bissau officially kicks off the AFCON tournament today, Saturday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, Information Minister Patrick Muyaya says the administration in Kinshasa is committed to bringing peace to the country. He says officials are working with international partners, including the United States, as part of this effort. His remarks come after dismissing a recent agreement signed between the M23 rebels and Cornel Nanga, a U.S.-sanctioned former chairman of the Electoral Commission called CNE. This as the electoral victory of President Felix Tshisekedi was confirmed by the Constitutional Court. CNE declared the incumbent president winner of the presidential contest with more than 70% of the vote. For more on the latest development and the plans of the president ahead of his swearing-in ceremony on January 20, I reach Information Minister Patrick Muyaya.
We as government, we are committed on bringing back peace in the eastern part of DRC. And every kind of initiative coming from different people go in the way of making wars again is something we condemn it, and then the government will take measure to make sure this adventure doesn't get any progress inside the eastern part of the DRC. We know. And from that, we have already set up a platform where we can provide different answers militarily, diplomatically, judicially, economically, etc. So the only thing we are doing now is to make sure we finish the president's inauguration, and then we're going to continue to work closely with our military or in diplomatic level to bring back the solution on all those different questions.
Well, Mr. Muyaya, I understand the U.S. government has sanctioned Cornel Nanga, and your government said M23 is a rebel terrorist group. Does that make Mr. Cornel Nanga a rebel too? Is that how your government sees it?
Please, Peter, I don't want to react on things about him.
Okay.
We are government. We are committed to bring back peace. It's the same movement because he's working with M23, etc. For us, they are all the same.
Talk to me about the president's second term agenda. What is his main agenda for the second term?
The second term will be what we call in French. I don't know if the word works in English, consolidation. Yes, the president for the past 5 years, he's been working on some main issues like bringing back peace in the eastern part of DRC, especially by reforming our military forces. We've been working on free education program, free maternity program, and some of local initiative, especially inside our 145 territory. In the coming 5 years, we're going to more focus on that, on consolidating what we started. We will switch from free education in the local, in the minimum age, to secondary level. We will work to make sure the couverture santé universelle, which is the big reform of our health system, will be able to be fully implemented. We will continue what we've been doing for our military. We will continue what we've been doing to strengthen our diplomatic system and all those things we've been working on closely. So it means that the coming 5 years, we're going to make sure what we have started in the previous five years gets consolidated. We get more progress, of course, for Congolese people.
So, Mr. Muyaya, for those Congolese who live in areas controlled by these rebels, as well as other rebel groups in the country, what should they expect from the president in this consolidation effort?
The first thing they have to expect is that we are very supportive. We are supporting them. We are in compassion for what they've been, what they are having as a situation with those rebel and terrorists who commit massacre, etc. What the government is doing is to do its best to make sure we bring back peace. And to bring back peace in that part of DRC requires a lot of things. That's why you have seen in the past month, we've been working closely with responsible of United States, especially Madame Avril Haines, who lead the community of intelligence to see the way we can find a way to finish the war with Rwanda. And, you know, we have a diplomatic process, we call it the process and Luanda processes. We'll make sure through those initiatives we find the way it can help to have a sustainable solution for this part of DRC.
What is the present message to the people of DRC, especially for those who are challenging or challenged his re-election, who are saying the elections were not credible?
You know, it's democracy. When you are in a democratic system like here in DRC, people is right to protest or to say, okay, the president wasn't elected. It's part of freedom of expression. What you have seen in the past day, it was the most one of the most historic election we never had, because it was inclusive. People from outside of DRC, Congolese from diaspora, were able to vote for the first time. For the first time, we published, the result was published during the day. No curfew, no diff, no violence, no nothing. It means that our democracy is progressing. So if in that context some of the opponents are not fair play or they cannot accept the result, it's their choice. They have the legal right to protest according to the law. But the president will deliver a speech around the day of his inauguration on January 20. Where you're going to send a message to all the Congolese people. But what the Congolese people has to know is that the president is the president of each Congolese everywhere they are, each opponent. And the president will act, he will do his best to make sure he's providing what Congolese people need: security, social security, education, etc.
For those who said that the president consolidation may not go far enough because he was not able to bring peace to the country, this is their argument. What assurances do you give them?
You know, here you have to analyze the situation for the past 20 years. Since the Rwandan genocide, Eastern of DRC is paying the consequence of what happened in Rwanda. Since 1994, we have this destabilization in the eastern part of DRC, especially because of Rwandan appetite, economic appetite, to make sure they are continue to destabilize DRC so they can take profit of our wealth there. But the president now, we are in an initiative where we can find a sustainable solution. It means that, as I was telling you previously, we are reforming our military system to have our army able to fight and to defend the territory. We are working closely on that. We have the diplomatic level. I was speaking earlier about the American initiative, about London process or Kenyan or Nairobi process. The solution won't just come with military confrontation. The situation is there for the past 25 years. At least now, we have a framework. We have the determination, we have the commitment of the president. It may take time, the way it's taking time, because you know sometimes diplomacy takes time, but we are sure that with the commitment of the president Tshisekedi, for the coming 5 years, we will be able to find a decisive or final solution of the situation in the East.
Patrick Muyaya is the DRC's information minister. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. Democratic Republic of Congo's Constitutional Court on Tuesday rejected two legal challenges to the provisional results of a contested presidential election last month and declared President Felix Tshisekedi the final winner. The verdict paves the way for Tshisekedi to serve another 5 years as head of Africa's second largest country and the world's top producer of cobalt and other prized industrial commodities. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached political analyst David Monda to find out what he made of the court's decision and what to expect in the second Tshisekedi term.
I think that was expected by the ruling made by the court, but I think it leaves the country still with a lot of questions still unanswered on two levels. One is the fairness of the electoral process. There were a lot of gaps, a lot of allegations of irregularities and corruption, but two, the political willpower of all the players in the DRC. Will Tshisekedi be able to bring the opposition together to work with him in parliament in order to solve public problems in the DRC? I think those are the two big areas.
There are a lot of candidates who are dissatisfied with the outcome and the whole process. What should we expect from President Tshisekedi to bring the country together?
I think he'll have to play some political maneuvering here because, we have veto players. In other words, we have some of the main opposition candidates who can really cripple any government efforts to bring the country together, right? So Martin Fayulu, for example, and a lot of the major opposition candidates can really make Tshisekedi's life difficult. But I think if he can bring them into some kind of governing coalition, or at least give them a soft landing either through ministerial appointments, I think that will be helpful going forward because the elections in many respects left a lot to be desired.
Opposition leaders aside, even non-political entities like the church, Catholic Church, and the other churches also had complaints about the electoral process. How vital are their input in bringing the country together?
Their input will be important. Civil society, the different civil society agencies, non-profits, the church, the international community, I think they will need to come together to ensure that Tshisekedi is governing from as broad a pool of players as possible. Because we shouldn't forget DRC in terms of its security, for instance, is still in a very precarious position right now after the East African Security Force left the DRC, and there's still questions about whether SADC will come back into play. And then we also know the country desperately needs economic growth and desperately needs security, with MONUSCO also leaving the DRC. So I think Tshisekedi really has his hands full. And this is the place where the civil society organizations and the church, faith groups can actually work together with political players going forward. But it's a very difficult situation because DRC has historically never had transitions of power. So this is one of those rare exceptions. And Tshisekedi will really need to be careful to manage this appropriately.
David Monda is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Johannesburg, South Africa. The government of Lesotho has endorsed Joshua Setipa as the kingdom's candidate for the position of the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. It makes Setipa the first Mosotho to run for the position to head the Secretariat of the Commonwealth. He is a former Minister of Trade and Industry in Lesotho. Observers say Setipa appears to be heavily tipped for the position. This after the Mountain Kingdom launched lobbying efforts in within the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, and other parts of the continent to support its candidate. Local media reports say Setipa faces stiff competition from candidates from Ghana and Tanzania. For more on what his candidacy means for the country and the prospect of success for Setipa, I reached Tapelo Maboti. He is the spokesperson for the Prime Minister of Lesotho.
The government of Lesotho have endorsed Mr. Joshua Paul Setipa as the candidate for Commonwealth Secretary General. And it is the first Mosotho to be given this kind of a responsibility within the that institution, the Commonwealth. And we are hoping the best for him, as he had been living within the, or succeeding working within the system, which is the Commonwealth system. And we believe that he's the right candidate for that particular position. We are hoping that all the government or the member states will definitely vote or give support to Lesotho with their candidate for Mr. Joshua Setipa to become Secretary General of Commonwealth.
What makes Mr. Setipa uniquely qualified that makes him the right person, the Secretary General of the Commonwealth?
Looking at professional career, you'll find that he's the right candidate for the position, and having worked within the institution where he's currently based as a senior director, and again, his experience, having been the managing director at the United Nations Technology Bank for at least for least developed countries, and again, you look at the positions that he occupied, like a senior consultant, also at World Bank, and he is a former minister, cabinet member in the Lesotho government, where he was a minister of trade and industry. His assignment, anyway, within the technology sector, where he was based at United Technology Bank, was to focus on the least developed countries, and most of these least developed countries are African member states.
Tapelo, I understand the administration in Lesotho has begun lobbying efforts. Is this news accurate?
That's true, Peter. We are trying to get all member states to vote for Mr. Setipa. We have to work together as Africans, especially the member, the Commonwealth member states, and beyond this time around, because Joshua Setipa is well known worldwide. He had studied at UK. He's working in UK. Most of the time, he had been around those institutions that develop countries. And I think he fully understands what is it that a Commonwealth wants to do and execute. Therefore, he's the right candidate. We are humbly asking our, especially Commonwealth member states, to vote for Mr. Setipa, give him this opportunity. And it would be a mammoth one for all of us. I mean the Africans, I mean the world, to have such a brilliant mind at a higher level of that institution.
What has been the reaction in Lesotho following the official endorsement, and what do you think his chances are of being elected or being chosen as the next Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations?
I think he stands a better chance, Peter, because he's currently working within the Commonwealth system. He knows the system better. He had been working with the Board of Governors within the Commonwealth. He'd been the Secretariat as well. For now, I think this is a moment of opportunity for him. And he had been around the world. He had been there for different countries. He had been there for representing World Bank, Commonwealth, and other institutions at a higher level. Giving him will be a moment opportunity for all African member states, all Commonwealth member states,
to benefit from him as a secretary general. He fully understands the job. And for Lesotho, I think it's one of the best opportunity, and everyone is already celebrating as if Joshua Stipa has been selected. And I believe everyone will be working hard, will be rallying behind Mr. Stipa, as they have already started, not only on government side, even the private sector have shown some support for Mrs. Deepa to occupy such a huge position. And we are looking forward for a positive outcome, him becoming the Secretary General of the Commonwealth.
Thapelo Mabotse is the spokesperson for the Prime Minister of Lesotho. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. In Uganda, the chairman of the Electoral Board of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, has sharply denied media reports of divisions within the group. Boniface Toterebuka also says the party will soon open nominations for interested members to file nominations to represent the FDC in the next general election in 2026. His remarks come after Justice Simon Beabakama, a chairman of the Uganda Electoral Commission, called on the FDC and other opposition parties to resolve their internal divisions before the elections. It also followed local media reports of internal divisions and conflict within the FDC, the Democratic Party, and the Uganda People's Congress. But Boniface Toterebuka tells me that the FDC is united, adding that reports of factions within the group appear to be a divide-and-conquer tactic.
But for him, if he says to put the house in order, that is his word. What is the problem? What is the worry? There is nothing to worry about. There is no faction, just one way for this, full stop. Even the chairman of the Uganda Electoral Commission, Justice Yabakamba Simon Mugeni, he knows where to find the FDC headquarters. He knows. We register with the Uganda Electoral Commission. So, where individuals can have views of whatever kind, it's upon those individuals. You will not stop them from thinking the other way around. But the National Electoral Commission of Yabakamba knows the legitimate program for democratic change, which is at Najana Nkumbi on Entebbe Road. He's very much aware and he recognizes that leadership.
But this is what he said. He said the law doesn't allow for such divisions. Just hear me a moment. He said at the moment the law recognizes Najana Nkumbi when FDC was registered.
That's right. That's right. Okay. What the law recognizes. It is the Najana Nkumbi, which will always endorse candidates. Please stop. It has the seat, it has the powers, it has the legitimacy. It is enjoying all the privileges of the party headquarters. Clearly now, you cannot have people with dissenting voices that's upon them.
So reports that there's one faction in Katunga and the other led by the Najana Nkumbi are false?
It's like a father, when you have your children disagreeing, you would want them to get united and they remain one. So he knows there is a different group. There is no doubt about it. He was just appealing to the other side if they can see sense and be on this side and become one. That's all. Otherwise, it can't go beyond that. There will be a group which will nominate a candidate that will be allowed by the Uganda Electoral Commission, chaired by Yabakam. By the way, it's almost a divide and rule. And it is the media which normally amplifies. You will see it everywhere, in cultural institutions, in political institutions, in religious institutions. You will always find two groups. As if they are fighting each other. It is intended, it is a political weapon to divide people. But as far as I know, one of the with one leadership at Najana Nkumbi.
So has the FDC's electoral body begun accepting nominations for those who want to represent the party? Have you started the process?
The process will begin with expression of interest. Once that one is done, then we go for nomination. Once that one is done, then we go for election. So but it's a roadmap. And we are going to sit and issue to all the party members. But the expression of interest will begin next 12th of this month.
Boniface Terubuka is the chairman of the Electoral Board of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The coalition of civil forces of Takadum, led by former Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok, signed the Addis Declaration with RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan or Hamedti on January 2nd. The agreement calls for a ceasefire without condition to be signed with the Sudanese army, ensures unfettered humanitarian access, and release over 450 prisoners of war. Sudanese military leader Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan has rejected an agreement and said this agreement is unacceptable and we will not consider it valid. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawi the reasons behind Al-Burhan's rejection.
Well, I think his rejection is primarily showing that, you know, he has the position that the Sudan Armed Forces should be part of any sort of negotiation having to do with the end of the war, the future of Sudan. And so by the fact that he was excluded, he is saying that therefore it has no meaning for him and for the Sudanese army. He does not want to recognize the Rapid Support Forces as an independent entity of equal diplomatic weight as the Sudan Armed Forces. At the same time, it's very notable, I think, that this agreement, we're seeing a re-energization of the civilians, the Sudanese civilians, who are bringing themselves into the center of negotiations, something that has been missing in previous rounds of negotiations. So I think that's very significant. Really, the civilians are the ones who are going to have to lead the country out of this conflict. And the fact that they are now the table, I think, is very meaningful, and that they're trying to facilitate some sort of dialogue. The Addis Declaration is also interesting in the details in that, you know, it's calling for a single army, and so it would require integration of the RSF and the army in some manner or form. It's explicitly saying the military and the RSF should pull out of economic sectors in Sudan, which has been an ongoing problem for economic development in the country. And it's also calling for democratic process, that there should be a democratic government with elected civilians at the helm. And so the substance of the agreement is actually quite interesting, and I think it represents a important step forward for giving us a place to have a concrete dialogue about what really needs to change in Sudan to end this conflict and move things forward.
But despite his rejection of the agreement, Al-Burhan invited the political forces to dialogue in Port Sudan, where he has relocated his residence and most government institutions. Could that lead to a compromise instead of the maximal position Al-Burhan is taking?
I think it could. I think Burhan wants to be a part of that dialogue. As I said, I think his main criticism is that he was excluded. And so the fact that he said that, I think, is significant. I'm hopeful that the civilian coalition, the Takadum coalition, will engage him and try and see if he will also sign on to a similar agreement, and then see if there's some sort of joint process there that can be navigated. You know, it's also interesting that this dialogue that we're seeing, it's really a intra-Sudanese dialogue. Most of the other negotiations we've been looking at have been promoted, facilitated by external bodies. And the expectation was that the Sudanese actors themselves couldn't talk directly. But the fact that they're talking, the fact that Burhan has said he would be willing to engage, I think is promising. And it certainly, I think, shows that there are incentives for him and the Sudan Armed Forces to be part of a negotiation and try to find a negotiated settlement to this conflict.
Kenyan President William Ruto expressed his appreciation for the commitment General Hametti has shown to ending the conflict in Sudan, and he pointed to ceasefire talks led by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, which was to end the war raging since mid-April of last year. He added, "We are looking for nothing but a peaceful solution and a stable neighbor." Would that give Hametti more credibility?
I think the African leaders who have been engaging in this dialogue around Sudan are really trying to just keep open lines of communication. They're trying to demonstrate that stability in Sudan is very important for the continent. The devastation caused by the implosion we've seen in Sudan is really rippling across, you know, many countries in the Greater Horn of Africa. And so there's strong interest within Africa to get this resolved. And I think, you know, what we're seeing from some of these African leaders, they're not taking sides. They're basically saying we need to engage in discussions. And if that requires talking to both sides, even when both sides have some serious human rights violations to account for, I think that's how we should be interpreting these efforts by the African leaders.
Joseph Siegel is Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El Shinawi. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, transport ministers from landlocked Central African countries say increasing commodity prices are causing civil strife in Chad and the Central African Republic. The ministers meeting in Cameroon Friday say the three countries will jointly tackle insecurity from Cameroon's Douala seaport. For viewing, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Central African transport ministers meeting in Cameroon say they want to find immediate solutions to obstacles facing the transportation of goods moving from Cameroon's Douala and Kribi seaports to landlocked Central African states. The Douala and Kribi seaports handle 90% of goods delivered to landlocked Chad and the Central African Republic, the CAR. The ministers and transport officials meeting in the city of Kribi this week said goods now take about a month instead of 2 weeks to arrive in Chad's capital, N'Djamena. Herbert Gontran Jono Ahaba is the CAR's transport and civil aviation minister.
Actuellement, avec les conflits dans d'autres pays frontaliers du Tchad,
Ahaba says current food price spikes that are causing daily protests in Tchad's towns and villages are fueled by insecurity, illegal police checkpoints, and the deteriorating state of roads along the more than a 1,400-kilometer driving distance between the Douala seaport in Cameroon and the CAR capital Bangui, and the close to a 1,600-kilometer driving distance between Douala and N'Djamena. Chad and the CAR say that last month's police used tear gas to disperse civilians in several towns and villages protesting hikes in commodity prices. There is a close to 35% increase in food prices, the two governments say. The ministers say price hikes have also been triggered by rebels who continue to attack goods in transit to Bangui on the CAR side of the border and Boko Haram terrorists operating in Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad. Central African states say that rebels last month harassed and seized goods and money from scores of truck drivers on the transport corridor to N'Djamena. Laurent Dihonet is the Secretary General of Chad's Ministry of Transport. He says the attacks, illegal police checkpoints, and abuses against drivers in transit in Cameroon suffocate trade and increase food shortages and hunger in the sub-Saharan African state.
Sur les 23 barrières qui ont été...
He says Cameroon, the landlocked CAR and Chad transport ministers have decided to dismantle 16 illegal police and military checkpoints on the corridor from Cameroon's Douala seaport to Bangui, capital of the Central African Republic. Diholet says the ministers have authorized the creation of 7 checkpoints that will assure the safety of drivers and their trucks and make sure goods, especially humanitarian needs, reach their destinations in the CAR and Chad. Cameroon, Chad, and the CAR also said they will dismantle over 70 checkpoints they say are illegally set up by Cameroon police and military along the Douala-N'Djamena corridor. Cameroon's police and military say the checkpoints are set up to control illicit trafficking of goods and protect truck drivers and their goods from armed groups, but the drivers say they are forced to pay illegal fees or bribes at the checkpoints. The transport ministers say joint military and police convoys will protect the drivers in areas prone to Boko Haram and CAR rebel attacks. Cameroon says it is negotiating with the World Bank, the European Union, and other international funding agencies to construct the roads and facilitate the passage of goods on transit. In their New Year's messages, President Mahamat Idriss Déby of Chad and Faustin Archange Touadéra of the CAR called for emergency food support for close to 5 million people they said are either facing hunger, threatened by food insecurity, or finding it especially hard to cope with rising prices. Chad and the CAR say millions of their citizens are also going hungry because of climate shocks, intercommunal tensions, and rising food and fuel prices. The UN's World Food Programme says that 1.4 million people in Chad, a country that has experienced an influx of over 600,000 refugees in less than a year from the fighting in Sudan's Darfur region, and over 2 million CAR civilians are threatened by a severe hunger crisis. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
As two more journalists are killed covering the war in Gaza, the United Nations says it is alarmed by the historically high death toll, with nearly 80 media workers killed since October. VOA Press Freedom editor Jessica Jarriott has the story.
A somber day as Al Jazeera Gaza bureau chief Wael Al-Dodu says a final farewell to his son, Hamza. A fellow reporter for Al Jazeera, Hamza Al-Dodu, is one of two journalists killed Sunday near Rafah. For Wael Al-Dodu, the loss adds to the family's grief. The bureau chief in October learned during a live broadcast that a strike had killed his wife, 15-year-old son, 7-year-old daughter and a grandson. His son Yair was seriously injured. And Dodu himself was injured while on assignment in December.
How can someone receive the death of their oldest son and everything in my life after I lost some of my family members, my wife, son Mahmoud, and Sham, and Adam? How can I receive this?
Dadu's son Hamza and Agent France press freelancer Mustafa Tarer were returning from an assignment Sunday when an Israeli airstrike hit their vehicle. The Israeli military told Reuters that the IDF had identified and struck a terrorist, and it was aware of the reports that two other suspects in that vehicle were also hit. The two journalists killed Sunday are the latest to die in what watchdogs say is an unparalleled death toll for media in war. As of Monday, at least 79 journalists have been killed, nearly all Palestinian, says the Committee to Protect Journalists. The high rate over a short period alarmed the United Nations. A spokesperson Monday reiterated calls that journalists not be targeted. Florencia Sotonino is an associate spokesperson for the United Nations.
To everyone all over the world, and this is increasingly hard in the conditions that they are facing over there.
Israel's embassy in Washington did not respond to VOA's request for comment. but its spokesperson has said previously its forces never deliberately target journalists. Investigations by groups, including Reuters, dispute that claim. Analysis last month found Israeli tank fire in October had killed the news agency's journalist Issam Abdallah in what appears to be a deliberate attack. Investigations found that Israel knew the location of the news team. Lebanon bureau chief Maya Gabeli says that Reuters is pushing for accountability, and she highlighted the dangerous conditions under which her colleagues work.
That it is a devastating pattern in which we're seeing journalists being unable to do their jobs and being prevented from doing their jobs by that kind of indiscriminate bombardment.
With intense fighting and access to Gaza restricted, accounts from local journalists are vital, she says.
When you have journalists who are there and who are providing these live feeds, it just makes accountability that much more possible.
As Dadu buries another of his children, the International Criminal Court confirms to Reporters Without Borders that crimes against journalists are included in its investigation into the war. Jessica Dreet, VOA News.
In Ivory Coast, the first football match between the host nation and Guinea-Bissau officially kicks off the AFCON tournament today, Saturday. The Elephants of Ivory Coast lock horns with the Jotters at the commercial capital Abidjan at 8 p.m. local time. Analysts say as the host nation, the Elephants of Ivory Coast are expected to triumph to win the match, especially with their array of key players who ply their trade in the major European leagues. But not much is known of the players from Guinea-Bissau. For the latest development ahead of the game this evening, I reach Mogbil Yarborough, who is currently in Ivory Coast on a special assignment to cover the competition.
The atmosphere here in Abidjan has been electric, Peter. Literally, there is so much fun chaos happening all across the city. You see fans trickling in from different parts of the continent and the entire country. Last minute yesterday, from what we were hearing from the Guinea-Bissau team, they had a flight coming in at 8 p.m. that had hundreds, about 200 super-duper last-minute fans that were coming in to support their team in that opening ceremony match. So all in all, there have been fans all over the city making sure that you know what team they're wearing. A Nigerian fan or multiple Nigerian fans were wearing the jerseys out in the city where when we were near the media center, a group of Cameroonian fans were chanting and had the vuvuzelas nearby. The Ivorians have always been out showing their team support. So, yeah, all in all, there's been so much going on.
So it looks all festive ahead of the first game between the Elephants of Ivory Coast and the Jotters of Guinea-Bissau. What are you hearing from the Guinea-Bissau fans? Because they seem to have been overshadowed by the massive population of Ivory Coast.
You know, sometimes, Peter, unfortunately, you always don't have the advantage of having being the host nation or, you know, having multiple fans in the thousands here to support you. But it's important and imperative that the Guinea-Bissau team uses this as a fueling for them to be able to showcase to the hundreds of fans that are here for them that, hey, we are here. Whether or not there's 60,000 fans in here that may not be supporting us, we will get the job done. And if they do get the job done, which is a tall task, it will start them off really, really well in this tournament.
So the pressure pretty much is on Ivory Coast to deliver with little to no expectation, but potential ability to upset the home crowd. How do you see this thing going, Mogbil?
Yeah, Peter, as we've said in the past, the pressure is on the home nation. They have the fans, they have the atmosphere, majority of it. They have all the recipe to make the cake, but it's up to them to be able to get the job done. Now, on the flip side, Guinea-Bissau should be coming into this game with a level head, understanding that it is a tall task, but no real pressure. No one's expecting them really to win outside of their fans. But I would say they are playing it they're in a very comfortable situation. You know, all they have to do is if they're able to just kind of get it rolling or even get the job done, even a draw in this game is more beneficial in my eyes to Guinea-Bissau than it is to Ivory Coast. So All the pressure is on the Ivorians, so we'll see if they'll be able to, you know, get the job done.
So before you go, Mugbil, what are you hearing about the organization of the tournament itself, the AFCON tournament itself? What are officials telling you? What are the latest developments ahead of today's mega kickoff to begin the tournament?
So the main thing is not really about the fan perspective just yet. It's more so about the media credentials, which has been very, very challenging. They've had about 5,000 applicants for media credentials across the continent and the world for this tournament, and have accepted a little over 3,000 at the moment. So at the moment, I think that is really where they were concentrating on heavily yesterday, trying to make sure that everything gets situated, but still, everything has not been sorted yet. As we know, the ceremony is happening literally later on today. So with that being said, we understand that maybe in the next coming days, things will lighten up and they will be able to kind of have the stress and the pressure of the opening ceremony out of the way. And then slowly but surely, things shall get sorted for the rest of the media teams. But outside of that, everything seems great. I will be excited to see what the fans are doing and how they're looking heading out there. I will keep you all updated on how it is looking on the ground from Abidjan in front of the stadiums across the country.
My colleague Mugbil Yaburu is on a special assignment to cover the AFCON in Ivory Coast. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Abidjan. And right now it's time for music from African Collection.
papangana motema mpenzi love felite suki na nzoto kasi na motema te kuna nde sika na loja dance love forteresse sécurisée infranchissable ata Guillaume le conquérant lingaki ko franchir te po bolingo na yo dance love fortification na mboka ya motema na ngai mama motema lokola baselunaire ekose divise mpe kose multiplie yango moto akoki kobomba ne 3-4 amour kasi yanga motema indivisible place moko se ya dance love mon amour kapasita motema nanga bolingo lwe satura yango bebe espace insuffisant pour d'autres amours ekosembana efase yo po mosusu a remplace kasi moye yako efase yo na motema nanga ezali te mon amour ozali atome moko ya oxygène oyo ezangaki na deux atome ya hydrogène po esala mai polo se la vie dance love tu es ma vie mama tu es ma vie l'amour éternel pour la vie je te comprends tu me comprends on se comprend dance love l'amour de ma vie à ta puissance agonie na lile du son et quoi ça qui t'es chéri banda konyo soa bolingo dance love pour le meilleur et le pire mama pour le meilleur et le pire Claudicia attaque au bolingo et wimeli bana bakoli kasi bolingo na yo na motema nangeza kaka ya sikai kolela te kobanga te seskula loba nye 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 tata bo moko mama bo moko ekolo be moko mokonzi moko atako ba ministre bazali ba genero pe bazali kasi na motema nanga mokonzi se yo moko dance love mi balete mama mokonzi mama mokonzi mi balete mi balete son altesse Sidi Kanyasi bande konanga ndenge ka gezalaka frère nanga ya utaki mboka ekotala biso na Kinshasa siko na tanga retour to décider na mère to kendo tika eti na mboka Matina bato ngai mer mokumbi bato na frère na ngai kokomi na katikati ya lac bato edini mer mokumbi bato.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it.
Na sauvé mutu moko na recevé nani entre mer frère na ngai.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Impoga and engineer Al Santos, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the kola nut is not as sweet as the coconut, yet it's eaten with respect than the coconut. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.